WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. Crossing President Trump comes with consequences. A day after Trump threatened his political future for voting against his budget bill, North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis says he's done and he won't run for re-election next year. His correspondent Nicole Killian.
Potentially faced a very challenging race. Of course, this comes after he expressed his opposition to the president's so-called big, beautiful bill. In fact, the president has been very vocal on his Truth Social platform over the last 24 hours or so, threatening a primary challenge against Tillis.
As for the bill itself, here's CBS's Christiane Benavides.
The legislation extends tax cuts from President Trump's first term, removes taxes on tips and overtime, and increases spending for defense and border security. Opponents of the bill argue it would make significant cuts to Medicaid and food stamp programs.
The legislation has created a lot of confusion among members of both parties. Washington Post Congressional Economics correspondent Jacob Bogage.
If you think what's happening in the Senate right now is difficult, just wait until this thing gets back to the House. There are members who say they can't recognize the bill and that they are just getting jammed by the Senate into voting on something that they don't like.
President Trump is still saying U.S. bombers obliterated Iran's nuclear program, but the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says he doesn't think so. Rafael Grossi tells CBS's Face the Nation he believes Iran could resume uranium enrichment in a matter of months.
It is clear that there has been severe damage, but it's not total damage, first of all. And secondly, Iran has the capacities there, industrial and technological capacities. So if they so wish, they will be able to start doing this again.
He says diplomacy is the only solution for Iran. One person is dead, two injured after an explosion that leveled three homes in North Philadelphia. Here's KYW's Shara Day Howard.
An earth-shattering boom. Three homes collapsed, 10 homes impacted, and an entire block evacuated as crews searched for survivors under the rubble. Assistant Chief Charles Walker.
After pulling through some of the rubble, we were able to find that we actually did have another victim.
With glass and debris everywhere, officials confirmed one elderly woman was killed and two others were injured in the collapse. Charity Howard for CBS News, Philadelphia.
It's a blistering heat wave in southern Europe with temperatures higher than 100 degrees in a lot of places. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco.
Sweltering temperatures across Spain and Portugal as a mass of hot air pushes up from North Africa.
And you can add Greece and Italy to that list. This CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman. A Wisconsin researcher wants you to think about your water utility.
Although drinking water is essential, most citizens and elected officials don't think about these systems until something goes terribly wrong.
That's Manny Teodoro, an expert on water infrastructure and a professor at UW-Madison. He leads the Wisconsin Waterworks Excellence Project. The goal? Highlight where Wisconsin's 572 water utilities are outperforming and where they're struggling.
People can't see leaky water pipes. People can't see treatment plants that are on the verge of disaster.
He's issued report cards, which grade utilities on water quality, operations, infrastructure, and finances. Teodoro says he's a tough grader, but still 92% of utilities across Wisconsin have gotten an A for water quality. Cities like Neenah, West Dallas, and La Crosse earn strong marks overall, but still struggle with aging systems.
These three cities are examples of professional, well-managed utilities that are frankly performing heroically with very, very old infrastructure.
The project uses data already collected by the state's Public Service Commission and the Department of Natural Resources. Teodoro says he'll release report cards every 2 years and eventually add metrics for how water tastes, smells, and looks. Some utilities already shine in that area. Northeast Wisconsin Bureau Chief Lisa Hale.
Attendees of the American Water Works Association conference sampled waters from across the country and voted on the People's Choice Tap Water Taste Test. Appleton, came in second, right behind Denver and above Bloomington, Minnesota. In a Facebook post, the city of Appleton congratulated its water team, saying, quote, "Your commitment flows through every drop."
Find your utilities grades by searching for the Wisconsin Waterworks Excellence Project. For Civic Media News, I'm Shally Pittman.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Becoming partly cloudy tonight, we'll see a low around 64. On Monday, mostly sunny, slight chance of an afternoon storm, highs in the low 80s. Clear and 60 for Monday night, and we're back in the low 80s with lots of sun on Tuesday. 83 with a chance of storms Wednesday. Right now, it's 82.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I talk Action Wisconsin and film incentives with Jeffrey Kurz and Nathan Deming. And Kurt Newman of the legendary Bodines joins the show. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This, the second hour of our special edition of Amicus Law Review, commissioning this second hour as we have both the first hour today and our broadcast yesterday morning on Saturday, because we are so focused upon the Supreme Court and the importance of its ruling, commissioning us once again to be informative and educational and affording you the opportunity to hear exactly what it is that our Supreme Court justices are writing about, the disagreements that they have, some of them quite virulent, and affording you once again the opportunity to determine on what side of the aisle, on what side of these legal arguments you come down. Don't have to be a lawyer, don't have to be a judge, do not have to be practiced or studying the law. Much of this, and it's the reason why I read so much of the commentary, so much of the express statements by our justices, much of it is common sense. And you may or may not agree with the results of those arguments, but it is accessible in the common domain, the common understanding of language, and the ways in which we understand the worlds in which we live. We begin in this, the second hour of our special Sunday afternoon program, by talking about a matter no less controversial than what we talked about in our first hour. That first hour, of course, focusing upon this case coming out of Texas and whether or not it is an unconstitutional violation of the First Amendment to impose age restrictions and age verification structures upon people, including adults who are accessing pornographic materials on the internet. The Supreme Court, in the end, applying an intermediate scrutiny approach and saying that, yes, indeed, this passes muster. No inhibition on the First Amendment here. The dissenter is plainly saying, no, this should be a much higher standard, and suggesting that even under strict scrutiny, this higher standard, this legislation could have been recrafted in a way that meets the interests of the state legislature and the legislatures in about 19 other states around the country that have enacted similar legislation, meets the interest in ensuring that children, youth, people under the age of 18 do not have access to any of this. No one disputes that appropriate limitation on young people, but doing it in a way that also provides other remedies in a less restrictive manner for those adults. Again, subjects that reasonable people can disagree on. It is fascinating as a First Amendment matter, and that is the why it is significant the Supreme Court takes it up and further defines, not only for the 20 states that are passing this kind of legislation, but also further defining all of our jurisprudence when it comes to First Amendment analysis, the right to free speech and related issues. The next topic is no less controversial, as I just indicated. This one is at the intersection of all sorts of hot topic issues these days, and we'll expose both the merits, demerits of the arguments along the way. This involves a Maryland school district. You know this case well. We've talked about it before here on Amicus. It is at the intersection of LGBT rights and prerogatives and even educational pieces, and the intersection of academics and schoolhouses, and also the intersection with parental review and authorization to not only opt out, but also to dictate to teachers what can and should be instructed to their students. What kinds of instruction? What is the academic curriculum that schools can and should adopt? Can parents overrule that by opting out of particular kinds of things in their public schools that they themselves, for religious reasons, and that's the third intersection here, it's a religious case as well, for religious reasons, they find objectionable. A lot going on here. What's this case all about? And why is it important in all of those areas? The Supreme Court, just once again, this past week, finding that public schools, again, not private schools, public schools in Maryland have to allow parents with religious objections. There's your religious piece. That's the First Amendment piece here. To withdraw their children, to remove their children from classes in which storybooks with LGBTQIA themes are discussed. That's the ruling of the majority of the Supreme Court just on this past week. The vote, once again, as before, 6-3, same delineations on the left side, the right side of this petition, and this final disposition. The case, of course, is one of many that the Supreme Court has addressed in the area of religion and also academics and also teacher prerogatives and LGBT rights. All kinds of things intersect. Let's take a brief note of some of those that we have discussed in the past. And we know well the court has ruled in favor, for example, last term of a web designer coming out of Colorado. Remember this case? Said she did not want to create sites for same-sex marriage couples. The Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, we will grant you that right to deny, to refuse to engage in commercial contracts with same-sex couples in putting together websites. They favored a high school football coach. Remember this one? Fairly notorious and famous high school football coach who said he had a constitutional right to pray with members of his football team at the 50-yard line, public venue, public school, after his team's games. And also the Supreme Court has favored and sided in favor of a Catholic social service agency in Philadelphia. Remember this case? That said it could defy city rules, refuse to follow city rules, and refuse to work with same-sex couples who had applied to take in foster children. So there is a lot of recent history here. There is a lot of religious focus here by the Supreme Court. We will talk at the end of this hour about some of the other cases in this area that the Supreme Court has also decided, including that Oklahoma matter, 4-4 decision, finding that indeed there is still such a thing as an establishment clause in United States jurisprudence. But here, once again, intersection of religion and academics and First Amendment rights and parental review as well. All kinds of things going on here. The Supreme Court, 6-3, once again saying that the public schools in Maryland do have to give parents the right to opt out and basically prohibit their children, take their children out of those classes in which storybooks with gay and transgender themes are discussed. They have a religious right to do that, to withdraw their children from those classes on days in which those books are specifically discussed. Now, the case concerns a new curriculum that's adopted in 2022 for pre-kindergarten through fifth grade students in Montgomery Public Schools. That, of course, is in Maryland. That's Maryland's largest school system in the state. The storybooks, and I mention this because of something else that is atypical, not unheard of in the opinions that we're about to discuss, but the storybooks include a book called Pride Puppy. It's an alphabet primer about a family whose puppy gets lost at a pride parade. There's a book called Love Violet about a girl who develops a crush on her female classmate. There's a case called Born Ready about a transgender boy.
and Uncle Bobby's wedding, which looms large in all this, about a same-sex union, a same-sex marriage. Now, where does this all come from? What is the genesis for all of this happening? Well, once again, as I indicated, this case called Mahmoud versus Taylor, that's the name of it, Mahmoud versus Taylor, decided just late this past week. During the course of the 2022-2023 school year, Montgomery School Board of Education there introduces a variety of LGBTQ inclusive texts into the public school curriculum. That's how this all starts. And those texts include, including the books I just described, five LGBT inclusive storybooks approved for students in kindergarten through fifth grade. Stories that include focus on sexuality and gender. Parents in Montgomery County sought to have their children excused from instruction involving those books based upon their religious beliefs. The board initially compromised with the parents by notifying them that when those books would be taught, they would be permitted to have their children excused from the instruction. That compromise was consistent with the board's guidelines for respecting religious diversity, which, again, this mix of all of these things, professed a commitment inside the school district to making reasonable accommodations for the religious beliefs and practices of students. Now, that seems all good and well. What happens is it becomes cumbersome. Less than a year after the board introduced the books, however, it rescinded the parental opt-out policy, the board noting that it could not accommodate the growing number of opt-out requests without causing significant disruption to the classroom environment. In other words, if you look at some of the literature, some of the discussion of this, it becomes, frankly, burdensome for all the requests that are coming in, various kinds of requests, and also the execution of removing students from these classes for portions, perhaps not all of the classes in which these books are discussed. It becomes an administrative challenge. The petitioners then, after this opt-out process is completely rescinded, basically saying, no more, we're not going to do the opt-out process as well. They're a group of individual parents and some unincorporated association of other interested parties who also join in on this. The parents come from diverse religious backgrounds and hold what appear to be sincere views on sexuality and gender, which they hope to pass on to their children. That's a part of the record of this matter. Faced with the board's decision to rescind these opt-out processes entirely, when they're faced with the prospect that, no, you can't opt out at all, the plaintiffs here file a lawsuit, U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, and they assert that the board's no opt-out policy infringed their rights to the free exercise of religion. This, again, is where the parental aspect and the educational aspect and the religious aspect and, yes, indeed, the LGBTQIA aspect all collide, if you will. They relied heavily on a case called Wisconsin versus Yoder. We've talked about that before. In that case, the court recognized that parents, in fact, have a right to direct the religious upbringings of their children, and that right, according to the Supreme Court, can, in fact, be infringed by laws that pose, as the court said, a very real threat of undermining the religious beliefs and practices that parents wish to instill in their children. The petitioners, the plaintiff, parents here, and the others then sought a preliminary, here's the word once again, injunction. They wanted to stop the school district from refusing to permit this opt-out process from going ahead, prohibiting the school board from forcing their children and other students over their objection to read, to listen to, or discuss the storybooks themselves. The district court denied that relief. A divided panel of the Fourth Circuit affirms. And here's the headline. The Supreme Court, again, in this major case involving all of those interrelated issues, the parents challenging the board's introduction of the LGBTQIA inclusive storybooks, along with the decision to opt out, to withhold the opt-out process, those are entitled to a preliminary injunction stopping the school district from prohibiting opt-out and from insisting on the books being presented. As we continue, we'll tell you more about what the majority said. We'll hear, of course, from the dissent, too, as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Environmental groups say the Midwest grid operator, MISO, is pushing an emergency energy plan that discriminates against wind and solar, the two cheapest ways to produce energy in our state. The plan favors fast-tracking construction of gas-burning power plants at the expense of clean energy projects. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rejected a similar plan from MISO last month, but environmental groups say this one is even worse, with few guardrails to ensure fossil fuel projects are actually needed. Once again, Wisconsin had the biggest wild turkey season in North America. More than 50,000 wild turkeys were harvested in our state this spring. The Department of Natural Resources reintroduced the birds into our ecosystem in 1976 and has been managing the hunt ever since. For a deep dive into Wisconsin's most pressing environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Ever since I started the recombobulation area, I've written an in-depth breakdown of every new edition of the Marquette University Law School poll. The newest poll asks about a range of topics, whether Tony Evers should run for a third term, where people stand on Donald Trump's economic policies, and a host of issues relating to the state budget. The poll paints a picture of a polarized Wisconsin. Many people are very dug into their partisan camps, which is perhaps to be expected in the most evenly divided state in the nation. But there are a number of issues polled that do have the support of more than two-thirds of Wisconsin voters. Those include extending Medicaid coverage for new moms, legalizing marijuana, making major increases in state aid for special education, providing mental health services in schools, allowing citizen-led ballot initiatives, and banning cell phones in schools. What do most of these issues have in common? They are policies being advanced by Democrats in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
Snakes, zombies, public speaking, the list of fears is endless. But the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. Distracted driving is what's really scary, and even deadly. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review, a special edition on this Sunday afternoon because we've got so much to talk about. That includes these major decisions coming out of our United States Supreme Court in recent days. 66 opinions altogether in this docket for this calendar year, this term of the Supreme Court that began way back in the previous calendar year, continues over the summer into late September. We're talking specifically now about this major case, intersection of religion and academics and parental rights and LGBT rights and First Amendment rights, all kinds of things in this case coming out of Maryland. Public schools in the end told by the Supreme Court that they must allow parents, at least at a preliminary nature, a preliminary basis right now, they have to allow parents with religious objections to withdrawing their, having their students exposed to storybooks with LGBTQIA themes. They've got to be permitted to withdraw their students from those classes. And it basically affirming the right, the religious right of parents to do that, and telling the school board itself that its opt-out process has either got to be enforced or on a regular basis, some other remedy has got to be identified here. The storybooks, as I read in the previous segment here, interesting because in both the majority and the dissenting opinions here, something happens. And I encourage you once again to take a look at them, even if you don't read through all of the lengthy. And it is lengthy. Lots and lots of paper, lots and lots of pages here from both the majority and the dissenting justices. They do something else from time to time happens. And specifically what they do here is they append to the opinions color pictures from some of these books. Both the majority does it and the dissent do it plainly to make their own points about the nature of these books that are being presented in the Maryland School District to kindergartners and on, maybe plainly so that you take a look at those and determine, yes, for yourself, but also to underscore their points that on the one hand, these do in fact infringe the religious liberties of the parents who maintain that these kinds of books are contrary to their religious views. On the dissenting side, that these books are fairly benign and that they basically promote interest in human interaction and good lessons that all schools should adopt and pursue. How do we get there? How do we get there? Well, again, Supreme Court, in an opinion, this one authored by Sam Alito, it is joined in by the Chief Justice, John Roberts, also by Thomas and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Barrett. You know who the dissenters are then. That's Plenty Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson. What the Supreme Court says in the majority opinion is that the parental position is just this, that the position of the school board is untenable. And they maintain in the end, that is the Supreme Court, that the parents are indeed likely to succeed on their merits, that the board's policies unconstitutionally burden their religious exercise. That's a significant finding. The court, the majority says, has long recognized the rights of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children. Those rights, they say, in this case, Mahmoud versus Taylor, the majority opinion, it is the law of this case. Those rights are violated by government policies that substantially interfere with the religious development of children. Goes on to say this, for many people of faith, there are few religious acts more important than the religious education of their children. All sorts of citations here, including to some cases that are seminal in this area. And the practice of educating one's children in one's religious belief, like all religious acts and practices, receives a generous measure of constitutional protection. This, again, is what the majority says in support of the parents. The Constitution protects, for example, a parent's decision to send his or her child to a private religious school instead of a public school. That's this case called Pierce versus Society of Sisters, a major case in the jurisprudence of this area. And the court, as it goes on to say, has recognized limits on the government's ability to interfere with a student's religious upbringing in a public school setting. Citing Barnett, for example, the court held that a policy requiring public school students to salute the flag could not be enforced against Jehovah's Witnesses, who consider the flag a graven image consistent with the First Amendment. Burnett involved an egregious kind of direct coercion, a requirement, this again is in the majority opinion in this case decided just last week, a requirement that students make an affirmative contrary, an affirmation rather, contrary to their parents' religious beliefs. In Yoder, the court held that the Free Exercise Clause also protects against policies that impose more subtle forms of interference with religious upbringing of children. Then, getting to the substance of this, the majority says the board's introduction of these LGBTQ-inclusive storybooks, combined with its decision to withhold notice to parents and to forbid this opt-out process, substantially interferes with the religious development of petitioners, those are the plaintiffs, the parents, the petitioners' children, and imposes the kind of burden on religious exercise that the law and the Constitution makes unacceptable. The books, they say, are unmistakably normative. They are designed, this according to the majority, to present certain values and beliefs as things to be celebrated, and certain contrary values and beliefs as things to be rejected. And here is where we get into the specifics. It's the reason why the majority, and yes, indeed, the dissenters, both attach specific references, visual references. You can read them. You can pull these opinions up and take a look for yourself, not only going to the website and finding the books themselves, but also seeing them right in the orders themselves. When we come back, I'll tell you more about exactly what the majority says about those books, and then, of course, what the dissenters view in the opposite direction. All that as our discussion of religion and education and LGBT issues continues here on our broadcast. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis says he won't run for another Senate term a day after President Trump threatened to support primary opponents next year. CBS's Nicole Killian says it's all about the big, beautiful bill.
Not only did he vote against moving forward to consider the bill, but he also told reporters late Saturday that he is a no on the final bill.
As it heads towards its conclusion, many Americans are struggling to feed their families. James Cunningham is the head chef for Bread and Roses Soup Kitchen. Los Angeles.
With a lot of the support programs getting cut, more people are slipping through the cracks.
A week after the U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear program, there's still no clear picture of how much damage was done. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham tells ABC's This Week, look at the big picture.
It set the program back, I think, a couple of years. But the question for the world, does the regime still desire to make a nuclear weapon? The answer is yes.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
Another home run for Ortiz. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball. Earlier this season, the Milwaukee Brewers shortstop, Joey Ortiz, was really struggling at the plate. His batting average was down to 188, and he was in danger of losing his job. This week, Ortiz hit two home runs in the same game. Yesterday, he had another, a two-run homer in the Brewers' 5-0 win over the Rockies. I asked Ortiz, was his extended hitting slump tough to get through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like my teammates kept my head out a lot more than they know, especially early when I wasn't really getting the results I wanted. Everyone does a great part to make sure that your teammates are doing a good job, making sure they're in a good position mentally, and yeah.
And we learned that Brewers center fielder Garrett Mitchell, who re-injured his left shoulder in Nashville over a week ago, running the bases, will have to undergo surgery again this Tuesday, although it's possible he could return at the end of this season. From American Family Field, with Sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. How do actors cope with being part of a really dark horror film? Violet McGraw and Allison Williams, stars of Megan 2.0, made themselves happy when the cameras weren't rolling by singing Taylor Swift songs. The 37-year-old Williams and 14-year-old McGraw are both Swifties. McGraw, who plays Williams' niece in the film, says the two bonded due to the dark material, and the way they ended up coping with it was by pretending to be Taylor. Megan 2.0 is rating fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and is currently in theaters. If mystery and horror isn't your thing, how about mystery and comedy? Peacock's remake of the 1989 Tom Hanks film, The Burbs, is gaining steam. The reboot is not a movie, but rather a series, and the cast is headlined by Kiki Palmer, whose credits include Nope and the recent surprise hit, One of Them Days. Palmer is also executive producing. If you're feeling nostalgic for the movie, you might dig the show, as it is filmed on the same street on the Universal backlot as the movie. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Becoming partly cloudy tonight, we'll see a low around 64. On Monday, mostly sunny, slight chance of an afternoon storm, highs in the low 80s. Clear and 60 for Monday night, and we're back in the low 80s with lots of sun on Tuesday. 83 with a chance of storms Wednesday.
Right now, it's 84.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Indy Duttagupta, he is with the Center for Law and Social Policy.
The Trump administration's agenda is reducing economic growth. The programs that they're proposing cutting, like Medicaid and SNAP, especially for kids, actually more than pay for themselves. So we are really looking at a tough long-term economic outlook entirely created by the current policymakers.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
It's National Handshake Day, but I find the idea that you just meet someone and you're holding a body part of theirs kind of odd. Hello, stranger. I'd like to squeeze your hand. Let's have an intimate act here. I have no idea where it's been or how you choose to use your hand in your spare time, but I'd like to hold it for a while. Unless it's a friend. Look, I don't know why we have to touch each other when we barely know each other.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Todd Alba.
Hey everybody, join us next time. Take a look back at the weekend headlines with Pat Kreitlow, Trigby Olson, and State Senator Kelda Royce on what's happening in the Joint Finance Committee. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are talking about this major decision issued by the United States Supreme Court. Case coming out of Maryland. It is called, once again, Mahmoud versus Taylor. I commend your reading of it. I commend your viewing of the opinion itself, because attached to the very decisions of the Supreme Court justices are excerpts from, and not just textual excerpts, they're actually reproductions of pages of these books. Take a look at them, determine whether or not what Justice Alito wrote about these books is accurate or not. It's significant that he is the author of what I'm about to read out loud. He says this. Take, for example, the message sent by books concerning same-sex marriage. He says, many Americans advocate with utmost sincere conviction that by divine precepts, same-sex marriage should not be condoned. Interestingly, he cites Obergefell versus Hodges for that proposition. Well, maybe somewhere in that very important Supreme Court case that affirms the right to same-sex marriage, there's a reference to those who object to it. He goes on to say that group includes each of the parents in this case. The storybooks, however, he says, are designed to present the opposite viewpoint to young, impressionable children who are likely to accept without question any moral messages conveyed by their teachers' instructions. The storybooks, again, Justice Alito says, on behalf of the majority, present same-sex weddings as occasions for great celebration and suggest that the only rubric for determining whether a marriage is acceptable is whether the individuals concerned love each other. That in quotes. The storybooks, he goes on to say, similarly convey a normative message on the subjects of sex and gender. Many Americans, like the parents in this case, he says, believe that biological sex reflects divine creation, that sex and gender are inseparable, and that children should be encouraged to accept their sex and to live accordingly. The storybooks, however, suggest that it is hurtful, perhaps even hateful, to hold the view that gender is inextricably bound with biological sex. There is more of that. The Supreme Court's majority opinion, again authored by Justice Alito, is 41 pages, and that does not include the attachments from some of these books, again, color versions of excerpts from them. Without an injunction, the parents, Justice Alito says, will continue to suffer an unconstitutional burden on their religious exercise, and such a burden unquestionably constitutes irreparable injury, entitling them to the injunctive relief that they are seeking. And for that reason, the parents in this case, they win, at least at this preliminary level. This is an injunctive case. Needless to say, as I've indicated, there are dissenters. And there's a dissenter in particular. We've already heard from her in this broadcast, and yes, indeed, in our Saturday broadcast as well. Her name, of course, is Sonia Sotomayor. Let's take a look at what she says. This is her opinion, also very lengthy, very lengthy. It itself is 39 pages in length, and that also doesn't include the attachments that she provides, also from the books themselves. She begins by saying, public schools, this court has said, are at once the symbol of our democracy and the most pervasive means for promoting our common destiny. They offer to children, she says, of all faiths and backgrounds, an education and an opportunity to practice living in our multicultural society. That experience, she writes in dissent, is critical to our nation's civic vitality. Yet it will become a mere memory if children must be insulated from exposure to ideas and concepts that may conflict with their parents' religious beliefs. Today's ruling, again, this is Sonia Sotomayor, joined in by Justices Kagan and Jackson. Today's ruling, she says, ushers in that new reality. Casting aside longstanding precedent, the court invents a constitutional right to avoid exposure to subtle themes contrary to the religious principles that parents wish to instill in their children. Exposing students to the message that LGBTQ people exist
and that their loved ones may celebrate their marriages and life events, the majority says, is enough to trigger the most demanding form of judicial scrutiny. That novel rule, she goes on to say, is squarely foreclosed by our precedent and offers no limiting principles. She gets back to that in just a moment. Given the great diversity of religious beliefs in this country, countless interactions that occur every day in public schools might expose children to messages that conflict with a parent's religious beliefs. If that is sufficient, she and the others say, to trigger strict scrutiny, then little is not. Once again, as we did in the case with respect to pornography coming out of the internet in Texas, this issue of the level of scrutiny to be applied looms large. Worse yet, she goes on to say, the majority closes its eyes to the inevitable chilling effects of this ruling. And here's what she describes about that. Many school districts, and particularly the most resource-strapped, cannot afford to engage in costly litigation over opt-out rights or divert resources to tracking and managing student absences. Schools may instead censor their curriculum, stripping material that risk generating religious objections. In other words, if this is too burdensome, as the Montgomery County schools found, they will simply say, let's get rid of the curriculum itself. The court's ruling, in effect, she says, thus hands a subset of parents the right to veto curricular choices long left to locally elected school boards. And there's the academic aspect of this. Because I cannot countenance the court's contortion of our precedent and the untold harms that will follow, I dissent. There's a whole lot more. The majority, she says, in any event, badly misreads the guidance provided to teachers. Far from directing teachers, she says, to accuse students of being hurtful when they express a degree of religious confusion, the guidance by the school district, she says, is plainly designed to foster mutual civility and respect. That purpose, she says, is clear throughout the materials. For instance, she says, the guidance suggests that in response to a child's statement that being gay, lesbian, queer, etc., is wrong and not allowed in my religion, a teacher could respond, again, according to this guidance, I understand that is what you believe, but not everyone believes that. We don't have to understand or support a person's identity to treat them with respect and kindness. In any community, we'll always find people with beliefs different from our own, and that is okay. We can still show them respect. That is what Sonia Sotomayor is not speaking to in her own dissent. Those are not her words. That's the guidance that is being provided to teachers in Maryland when you come to these circumstances. She goes on to say that recommended response is careful to respect the religious views of students while still encouraging civility and kindness toward others. Those values, moreover, are precisely what the parents in this case say they endorse. We believe, she makes reference to the record, we believe that all humans must be respected regardless of the person's faith, race, ethnic origin, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, or social status. We believe that all persons should be treated with respect and dignity regardless of religion, race, sex, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, or other characteristics. The dissent goes on to say this. To the extent students make comments that may be hurtful to classmates in the room, the guidance recommends teachers discourage that behavior. If a student says, for example, that's so gay, the guidance suggests a teacher may respond, regardless of how it's intended, using gay to describe something negative reflects a long history of prejudice against LGBTQ people. So please don't use it in that way. You may not have meant it to be hurtful, but when you use the word gay in any way outside of its definition, it's disrespectful. Similarly, the instruction goes on to say, if a child says that's weird, he can't be a boy if he was born a girl. The guidance encourages teachers to respond, that comment is hurtful. We shouldn't use negative words to talk about people's identities. The majority's dissent goes on to say, reads those portions of the guidance to direct teachers to accuse students of being hurtful when they express confusion based upon their religious views. The majority only reaches that conclusion, however, this again is Sonia Sotomayor writing for the dissent, by omitting portions of the student commentary to which the students are responding in the guidance. Comments like that, moreover, are sadly not uncommon in the nation's school system, and she provides information about all of that. In the end, she says this, the logic of the court's ruling must also apply to countless other topics. This is the opening of the floodgates issue. Apply to other countless topics, interactions, and activities that may conflict with a parent's religious preferences. And this is the practical application of what Sonia Sotomayor is warning against. She says, what of the parent who wants his child's curriculum stripped of any mention of women working outside the home, seriously averring that such activity conflicts with the family's religious beliefs? It blinks reality to suggest that the simple solution for schools is to create new discrete units of instruction to cover any set of materials to which a parent objects. The court's analysis, Sonia Sotomayor says, thus reflects all too well the obvious fact that courts are not school boards or legislatures and are ill-equipped to determine the necessity of discrete aspects of a state's program of compulsory education. In the end, she says this, today's ruling threatens the very essence of public education. The court, in effect, constitutionalizes a parental veto power over curricular choices long left to the democratic processes and local administrators. That decision, the majority decision, she says, guts our free exercise precedent and strikes at the core premise of public schools, that children may come together to learn not the teachings of a particular faith, but a range of concepts and views that reflect our entire society. Here we go. Exposure to new ideas has always been a vital part of that project until now. The reverberations of the court's errors will be felt, I fear, for generations unable to condone that grave misjudgment, I dissent. That's Sonia Sotomayor. Again, she attaches portions of the books, which you also can digest, even if you don't digest all of the well over 100 pages of material from the majority, which you should read, from the dissent, which you should read, as the Supreme Court, again, this past week, brings together all of these issues in another case involving religious freedom and says that in the end, the school district there in Maryland has got to provide either the opt-out process or, in the end, as Sonia Sotomayor indicates, has got to remove from its curriculum these things that, in the end, should be and are a part of an academic setting, an academic pursuit that exposes students of all ages and of all backgrounds to positions and views that encourage their education and their growth. Even as we have said in other cases and as we have talked in this broadcast, situations that expose them to things with which they do not agree. That's what the Supreme Court has done just this past week. When we come back, a couple more cases on the Supreme Court docket and then review of what has also been a part of the history of this term as Amicus, a law review, continues.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Look up cheese curds. You'll find this basic definition. Wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
America is kept safe because the Army National Guard responds, protects, and supports our nation when it needs them most. From fighting wildfires with air support, helping civilians in flooded neighborhoods, to delivering food and supplies to those who have lost everything, the Army National Guard always responds when disaster strikes. The Army National Guard also trains to be ever vigilant against threats, foreign and domestic. They protect our skies with missile defense weaponry. They secure our information, communications, and infrastructure with cybersecurity. And they protect us against chemical, biological, and radiological hazards with the civilian support team. The Army National Guard also stands ready to deploy and provide support for conflicts or humanitarian missions abroad. Join the Army National Guard and be there to respond, protect, and support your community and your country. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Matt and Air on Air.
From articles that I have seen, if you are a bagel purist, you should not toast your bagel. I think nothing's better than a toasted bagel and a schmear.
Folks, can we have a moment of honesty? Do you really like bagels? Or do you like the schmear that is transported by them? Get rid of the stigma. If I walk into this room eating cream cheese out of a tub with a spoon.
Why is that wrong?
Matt and Air on Air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Tracy Ann Mangold, how would you describe what it is that Brian Schimming is caught in the crossfires of?
He's the first paid state chair that they've ever had. And so the belief was that maybe that'll increase his ability to fundraise for the state. Obviously, that has not worked out so well. I've been told that he thinks 4 phone calls a day to fundraise is a lot, which, you know, isn't.
104 might be a good start.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this indeed is Amicus. Hello, everyone. A special edition coming to you on Sunday afternoon as a part of our extensive review of some of the major cases that have come out of the Supreme Court in just recent days and weeks. Here's one that has flown somewhat under the radar, also issued on Friday of this last week. It also deserves your attention, even if you choose not to read, again, the very extensive opinion written by the majority and also some dissenters in this case. It's called Federal Communications Commission versus Consumers Research. It has to do with the Communications Act of 1934, and specifically the commission to the Federal Communications Commission to make available to all the people of the United States reliable communication services at reasonable charges. And the objective is known as universal service. How does this particular case come about? Well, it has to do, once again, with broadband internet service being provided, therefore, to some of our more impoverished communities, our underserved communities out there throughout the United States of America. As is often related to these cases, the issue is not so much whether or not the FCC can do this. This is plainly a good thing to provide information access and internet access to those people in our nation who do not otherwise have it. It's a part of the FCC's commission. This case, like many others, once again turns on something much wonkier, much more specific, much more in the weeds. It has to do with a contribution factor to something called, once again, this universal aspect of the FCC's commission. I will commend your reading of this after you've read everything else. The upshot is that a majority of the Supreme Court upholds this universal service contribution over objections of some entities out there. It says that the scheme, the contribution scheme to the FCC to support this commission does not violate the non-delegation doctrine. That's the other reason why this issue, this case is important, because it basically says that, yes, indeed, the Congress can
indeed legitimately give to the FCC the authority to make this regulation. The non-delegation doctrine we have talked about before is this notion that Congress should not be giving to agencies, the experts, the people who know what they're doing, the authority to do exactly that, to act on behalf of the people of the American nation. Here, the United States Supreme Court says we're not going to apply the non-delegation doctrine. We are, in fact, going to permit the Congress to vest in the FCC the authority to do these things involving the universal service and the contribution required of participants. For that reason, the project goes ahead, and the FCC can, in fact, pursue this multi-million dollar, very expensive, but nonetheless important initiative to bring internet service and broadband services to areas of our nation. All of that also coming out of the Supreme Court just late this past week. I mentioned at the start of our broadcast today and also yesterday that while these are the hot topic cases of recent days, we are well mindful that there are 66 cases altogether. And in these final moments of our time together on this special edition, I'm going to recite to you just the other kinds of things that we have talked about on this broadcast, recognizing once again that we've got some split decisions and some unanimous decisions as well. We recall well this case involving transgender care for transgender youth, a 6-3 ruling on June 18th, finding that a Tennessee law that prohibits medical providers from prescribing puberty-delaying medication and providing hormone therapy to transgendered minors, ruling that it does not violate the Equal Protection Clause, equal protection principles. Remember this reverse discrimination case called Ames versus Ohio? This was a unanimous court ruling, Supreme Court ruling on June 5th, that members of majority groups do not need to meet a heightened burden to prove discrimination in the employment setting. The case involved, you may recall, a straight woman who said that her employer had discriminated against her in favor of some gay colleagues. Remember this case involving gun makers liability, the Smith & Wesson case versus the Nation of Mexico, a 9-0 ruling basically saying that the Mexican government may not sue U.S. gun makers over claims that they share the blame for violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Recall this 4-4 deadlock involving religious charter schools coming out of Oklahoma. 4-4 ruling on May 22nd, whether Oklahoma may use government money to run the nation's first religious charter school, which would have taught a curriculum infused with Catholic doctrine. An earlier ruling by the Supreme Court had blocked the school from being allowed to participate in the public school structures. And while Amy Coney Barrett recused herself, the 4-4 disposition there meant that that lower court ruling stands. That may return, as many of these other things may as well, to the Supreme Court. There was an excessive police force case, 9-0, also on May 15th. Supreme Court ruling that judges must consider all the relevant circumstances in their scrutiny of challenges to police shootings, and not just to the moment of threat that is posed to the police officer. The case concerns a police officer in Texas who shot and killed a motorist he had pulled over for some unpaid tolls after jumping on the car as he tried to pull away. A major enforcement case for law enforcement, an excessive force case having to do with the way the courts analyze those. There's a case on April 2nd, also 9-0, the FDA versus White Lion Investments, finding unanimously that the Food and Drug Administration had acted lawfully in rejecting applications from two manufacturers of flavored liquids used in e-cigarettes with names like Suicide Bunny, Mother's Milk, and Cookies. The court returned one aspect of that particular case to a lower court for some further consideration. Recall as well the infamous ghost guns case. Recall as well at 7-2 ruling on March 26th that indeed ghost guns, weapons kits that can be easily assembled into firearms, those can in fact be regulated by the ATF. All of that and more coming out of our Supreme Court this past term. Next weekend, we return to more of this analysis here on Amicus, a law review.
are listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. A day after President Trump threatened his political future for voting against the big, beautiful budget bill, North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis says he won't run for another Senate term next year. Here's correspondent Nicole Killian.
Senator Tillis has been warning his colleagues repeatedly about moving forward with some of these proposed Medicaid cuts, but many of the things that he objects to remain in this package, which is why he has said that he cannot vote for it.
In a series of social media post, Trump threatened to support Tillis's primary opponent, University of Virginia politics professor Larry Sabato.
Tillis has had it. This has happened before. You either agree with Trump and go along with what he wants, and you do so enthusiastically, or you become the enemy.
As for the bill itself, the Senate has started to debate after clerks finished reading the 940-page